Hello. How's that mic? Good?
Yeah.
Good. Well, welcome, and I do thank you for joining me today for this brown bag lecture on a messy, rainy day. I really appreciate you coming. My name is Aidan O'Connor. I'm a curatorial assistant here in the Department of Architecture and Design, and I've been here for just over 2 years. And I've had the great pleasure of working on this exhibition, Counter Space Design and the Modern Kitchen, which opened in September and is running through March. So it's not necessary that you've already seen the exhibition, but I hope that if you haven't, you'll be enticed after this to go take a look, or maybe see it again. And again, you have plenty of time. So I'd like to give just an overview of the exhibition, how we put it together, its structure, and tell some of the stories that emerged from the research in putting this exhibition together. Here are some installation photos of the exhibition as it is now. It's up on the second floor just next to Cafe 2. And you can tell it was definitely a fun exhibition to put together. It's drawn entirely from MoMA's own collection, but not only from the Department of Architecture and Design, but actually from every other curatorial department in the museum, which is a very special characteristic because it's not very common in exhibitions. But we really wanted to round out the architectural drawings and posters and graphics and design objects with works of painting and sculpture and media and film, in addition to some archival photos and film. So it's a very rich presentation of work, and I'll get to tell some of the stories of these objects.
Can we turn the lights
on? Yeah, look at those colors. So, what is this Frankfurt kitchen that you may have heard of that we've been making such a fuss about? The Frankfurt kitchen is the star of the show Encounter Space, and I will get into the history and the architect and how it came to be. But I just have these photos here, this archival photograph from 1926 on the left, and on the right, an installation photograph of our own Frankfurt kitchen, just to explain that whereas obviously the museum has been collecting kitchen-related objects and drawings and artworks for decades, really since its founding in 1929, the idea of a kitchen exhibition, which seems like kind of a basic idea, it's actually never happened before. And we like to think that it was our acquisition of our Frankfurt kitchen, which was just about a year ago, that really allowed us to kind of put all of the pieces together and gave a nice architectural context to the other objects and drawings already in the collection. So once we acquired the Frankfurt kitchen, which was a really major and exciting occasion for us, we were allowed to start with the research and start to put together this really great exhibition and round everything out. But I'll start at the beginning. The first section of the exhibition we called the New Kitchen. And I say we. I should have mentioned the name of the curator for the show, which is Juliette Kinchin, not Kitchen. So Juliette and I started with the New Kitchen. And here we're looking at the factors that feed into what is actually known, it's a period term, the New Kitchen, from the early 20th century. So what is creating the new kitchen? There are many social, technological, aesthetic, cultural factors at play. The photograph at the left, which is from our photography collection, is just meant to point out the idea of servants in the kitchen, which is starting to decline really towards the turn of the 20th century. And we're very interested in looking at the kitchen as kind of a portal, a magic gateway almost, where real innovations are entering the home. So new sources of energy like electricity, gas, cleaner sources of energy as opposed to solid fuels, which are very much a part of the old kitchen, you can see in the photographs here. Major innovations, life-changing innovations, are entering into the home and by extension entering into people's daily lives really through the kitchen. So to show this, I've included this Peter Behrens electric kettle. This is our earliest electric kettle of 1909. The very earliest electric kettles on the market were in the 1890s, but it takes time before they become really common in people's homes. A few other very important themes that we trace through the exhibition: standardization. Here we have a drawing by Catherine Beecher that was illustrated in her book with Harriet Beecher Stowe, The American Woman's Home in 1869. And here you can see the very clean and rational storage units for a kitchen, just below Wagenfeld's really beautiful cubist stacking storage containers of 1938. This is heat-resistant glass, and we'll see some examples of Pyrex and Corning glass a little bit later, but this is a nice early example. Sugar cubes you see all the time, don't really think about them, but they're developed in the 1870s. And the flat-bottom paper bag, which is really a long process of innovation and tweaking machines and adding the flat bottom as opposed to an envelope style, and then adding the pleats on the sides for easier folding and faster and more efficient manufacturing. If you're more interested in the flat bottom paper bag, I actually just posted yesterday on the MoMA Inside Out blog a whole story of the flat bottom paper bag with some really nice photographs of paper bag factories and also some patent drawings, which are really interesting if you're into patent drawings. Here's again the old kitchen, just to remind you what the major shift is coming from. So think about 19th century kitchens and earlier being often very dirty, poorly ventilated, kind of out of sight, out of mind in the case of homes where servants are the ones in the kitchen, and just not pleasant places to work, not efficient places to work. And it's really in the 1920s and 30s that architects start to look at the kitchen as a place that can be optimized in the home, and where ideas from factories and from laboratories can be assigned to domestic labor. In many cases, it's women conducting this kind of research. On the left is Christine Frederick, whose test kitchen and operation was based in Green Lawn, Long Island. That was the Applecroft Home Studies Institute. You can see her on the right in the kind of puffy white hat and the lab coat. And this is such a great picture because she's actually holding a stopwatch. It's like she posed for this photo just to be shown later in this exhibition. But it's just a wonderful way of showing this very scientific perspective, and the domestic reformers in the very late 19th century and early 20th century are thinking about pathways through the kitchen. You can see at the diagrams on the bottom, the left is the bad kitchen and the right is the good kitchen. So less dotted line means good kitchen. And this is obviously still with us today, the idea of the kitchen triangle and getting from the stove to the sink to the refrigerator. And here there's not a refrigerator, but it's this very same idea that you want to minimize the steps that you're taking, minimize labor, really think about what products you're bringing into your kitchen. And her operation also had kind of a consumer reports aspect to it. They were doing a lot of product testing. On the right, at the very same time, these are illustrations from a book that was written by Georgie Boynton Child, and this is called The Efficient Kitchen. You can see she's looking at organizing the kitchen in the most rational way. Hygiene, also a very important concern at this time, and it's all tied together. They want clean, rational, efficient kitchens, just like a laboratory. So here we'll get to the Frankfurt Kitchen, and the Frankfurt Kitchen is such an iconic work of 20th century modernism because its architecture, its design, it's part of the home, it's the heart of the home, and it's the context of the Frankfurt Kitchen is such a still interesting and really inspiring story. Here's the layout of the kitchen, but I just want to skip to these photos. The Frankfurt Kitchen emerged from a project that was known as the New Frankfurt. So following World War I, all around Germany, but we're concerned mostly with Frankfurt here, just wartime devastation, housing problems, and increasing inflation lead to the formation of a city municipal building department. Ernst May, the architect, is the head of this department, and he's the head architect for the city. And over the course of 5 years, from 1925 to 1930, in this New Frankfurt project, they actually created 15 new housing estates. And these were meant to be very modern in appearance. You can see at the photograph at the bottom left, but also very rationally and progressively planned to build in childcare, utilities, transportation, and also they're experimenting with prefabricated elements. You can see at the bottom right photograph the precast concrete slabs that they're using to build these housing estates. So 15 new housing estates. One of them is the Ginheim Hohenblick housing estate. And at Kurhessenstrasse, the corner, I'll use this pointer, the corner that you see in the photograph here, one of the reasons our Frankfurt kitchen is a very special one that we're really excited about is that we know really the exact provenance. It comes from this housing estate, this corner, this street, this building, and the second floor. There. Very specific. It's like powers of 10 when you focus down. This is on the top right, a plan of that housing estate. So we're talking about the corner. If I get this to work, the corner here. That's pretty cool, isn't it? These are the aluminum pouring bins that are in the Frankfurt kitchen. So we can talk about some of the features using this diagram. The kitchens are not only an integral part of the apartments in these new housing estates, but so well thought out and thoughtfully planned as design objects almost, as units. And there were about 10,000 Frankfurt kitchens that were put into the 15,000 or so housing units on these housing estates. And they have all sorts of innovative features, like this is a fold-down ironing board, number 4. There's a cook box that's like a slow cooker that's heated from the gas stove. All of them came with gas stoves, electric lighting. They had radio in them. These are kind of pull-out cutting surfaces. This is a part of the drying rack. It's a sloped metal piece that goes into the sink that's here, and that the drying rack actually lifts up, so you have additional storage there. All of the countertops are at the same height. It's integrated storage overhead and below. And there's a larder, which is number 5, and that's kind of the cooling box. It vents directly outside. So no refrigerator in here. That would come a little bit later in Germany, but there is this cooling box. So in the photo at the left, you can see the fold-down ironing board. So this is really planned out as a factory space, a laboratory space, no muss, no fuss, get your work done. But it's actually also quite pleasant space. You have this large picture window providing a lot of natural light, the electric light at the ceiling. There's a sliding door at the left, which is pretty wide, so the living room would have been on the other side of that. And so you can have access to other parts of the house, and maybe there are children in the living room. And there's a hallway door, which is, in this photo, that would be where we're standing and looking in. All of the kitchens also came with a little swivel stool, which is why the counters seem a little bit low, but it just makes sense that you can do a lot of work in the kitchen from a seated position. The aluminum pouring bins that I showed you the photo of, you can see them here in our kitchen. I should say that what's known as the Frankfurt kitchen actually applies to about 4 different layouts of Frankfurt kitchen. There were some that were a little bit larger, some even to accommodate a household servant, but most families in these housing estates, which were meant to be affordable, did not have household servants. So the Frankfurt kitchen that we have is actually the smallest and most affordable and most common layout. But over time, there were also slight variations. So in later iterations of the Frankfurt kitchen, the aluminum pouring bins were raised up so that kids couldn't make trouble with them. And there were also different colors. Ours is a nice kind of slate gray, but there was a blue and a bottle green and a yellow. So just so that you don't walk away thinking that the Frankfurt kitchen is one very specific thing. What is specific to the Frankfurt kitchen is the architect, and that's Margareta Schütte-Lachotsky, an amazing feisty woman who lived to 103. You can see her in all of these photos. And here, this is such a wonderful photograph because on the left, she's shown with the other members of that Frankfurt Municipal Building Department, and they're wearing lab coats. It's a very striking image, and she has such a great haircut, doesn't she? Schüttel-Hosky, so impressive. We believe she was the first woman to qualify professionally as an architect in Austria. She studied at the University of Applied Arts in Vienna and became an architect. And it was in 1926 that Ernst May, the head city architect for Frankfurt, summoned her to join this very dynamic and progressive league that he was gathering around him to really remake all of Frankfurt into a more kind of egalitarian and modernized city. So 1926, she heads to Frankfurt, and she's kind of assigned the kitchen. And the Frankfurt kitchen becomes almost a selling point for this city project because it's a kitchen designed by a woman for women. And it's a little bit unfortunate that Schüttel-Hosky is kind of pigeonholed as the designer of the Frankfurt kitchen, and she regretted as much later in life because she did other amazing projects in not only in Austria and Germany, but in Soviet Russia and in Turkey. And she had some trouble after World War II, during which she was imprisoned for her anti-Nazi resistance. Trouble finding work after World War II because she was a communist, but we're very happy to have our Frankfurt kitchen as such a star of counter space and have more attention directed at Schüttel-Hosky. She actually admitted herself that she was never really very into cooking, really hadn't spent that much time thinking about household management or run a house herself. She came from a very comfortable background in Vienna. And so this was really a new project for her, and she just tackled it head on, conducted a lot of experiments in the similar vein to the Christine Frederick time motion experiments. And she also conducted many interviews with women who did know about kitchens. So while this is a very forward-thinking design of a kitchen in terms of its layout and the integrated storage and the new technologies built in, she's also incorporating a more vernacular style of wisdom from her interviews with these housewives, such as using different materials appropriate for different functions. So the flour bins, flour is not stored in the aluminum bins, it's stored in oak containers, oak being understood to repel mealworms, and beech is used for the cutting surfaces because it's more resistant to food staining and marks from knives. So it's a nice complement, this more traditional knowledge being incorporated into this very avant-garde architecture. This is a chart that I think is very interesting from Taiga's 1932 book, The Minimum Dwelling. And it's you can see the Frankfurt kitchen in the chart, and then what's taken as the epitome of the efficient and rational operating kitchen is the kitchen of a railway car. So that's what many architects, not just Schüttel-Hosky, are looking to as their ideal model. And Taiga just uses these great keywords like the kitchen is a model workshop, a chemical laboratory, functional utility, hygiene, cleanliness, rationalization, saving time and energy. This is the focus of the first section of our exhibition. I should also mention Schüttel-Hosky said that Christine Frederick's book on household efficiency of 1912 was her Bible in designing the Frankfurt kitchen. This poster on the right is promoting the first working congress for CIAM, C-I-A-M, which is the International Congress of Modern Architects. All of the major leaguers are involved here, Le Corbusier and Gerrit Rietveld, and later Alvar Aalto, Hannes Meyer, and Ernst May. And so the first Congress is actually convened in 1929, and we can see it's one of the Frankfurt housing estate apartment layouts that is used on this poster as the epitome of this new dwelling. This is all part of the new Frankfurt, the new kitchen, the new dwelling. The repetition has meaning. And so it's a whole network of major architects and designers that begin to think about modernizing the kitchen. So here we have a Marcel Breuer, very beautiful tea cart, which we have parked outside of our Frankfurt kitchen and in the exhibition. So in this poster, the Frankfurt kitchen is here. And a couple of other illustrations of this idea of the minimum dwelling and trying to really compress the kitchen into the tightest, most rational space possible. This comical little Huebner collage kind of is almost satirical, but you have to be fully bent over and grabbing your legs to fit into this tiny dwelling. And then on the left, this is actually a recent acquisition to our collection, this poster by Hasbauer Walroth. And it's a nice complement to the Frankfurt kitchen, because not only are these two female designers, but whereas the Frankfurt kitchen is now the earliest work in our design collection by a female architect, this poster is now the earliest work in our collection by a female graphic designer. And this is a poster promoting an exhibition that was in Basel in 1930 that was called The Practical Kitchen. And the kitchen that you see in the drawing on the poster was designed by a Swiss architect, and it was actually on view in this exhibition. Rudolf Preisverk was the architect. And this model kitchen had a footprint of about 36 square feet. So this might win the prize for the most compact actual model kitchen that was being considered at this time. Here's another example, another female architect, Lily Reich, who worked with Mies van der Rohe, but we have a great collection of her drawings and also photographs, and this is one of her projects, an apartment for a single person that was displayed at the German Building Exhibition in 1931 in Berlin. So here you see almost a closet-style kitchen where it's all contained right in here, and you can draw down shades and cover this up, but you have a garbage can, and very, very rational. Jumping to America, and this is the second part of that first section of our exhibition. These are just a few everyday objects that are coming out of American designers in the 1920s and 30s. Some still very familiar to us today, like the Presto cheese slicer and our vegetable peelers. Later, I'll show a smart design OXO vegetable peeler. You can see what a great difference it is. But this is around 1944, Echo Products in Chicago. Echo did a whole range of kitchen tools, and they actually became really famous about 10 or 15 years before these vegetable peelers. They were the first company to put a little hole in the handle of kitchen tools so that you can hang them on the wall. Very simple idea. But this is just to show new objects, designers really starting to pay attention to the kitchen and the objects that go into the kitchen. Here are some very nice tea kettles. I think it's amusing that this John Rideout kettle, which is very striking in its appearance, actually has the design flaw of the handle, which is the lid is semi-permanently attached to this kettle because of how the handle is fixed. So you can only fill it from the spout, but it sure is a looker. And some more familiar objects, the Revereware, which is really developed around 1937 when Revere Copper and Brass Company perfect this method of electroplating copper onto the bottom of these stainless steel vessels so that you have the stainless steel is the body of the vessel, which is more resistant to food acid corrosion, but then the more even heat conduction from the copper bottom. So I'm sure many of you have this in your home still. I have it. Maybe you don't rest them on a bed of balsam leaves like they are in this advertisement, but it's really after World War II that this line takes off because metals are no longer diverted to military use. But the line is officially launched at the first International Housewares kind of fair, which is in Chicago in 1939. These are two illustrations to show different ways that the modern kitchen is promoted in the United States in the 30s. On the left, there's an installation photograph of the Machine Art Exhibition, which was a major groundbreaking exhibition here at MoMA, really the first very famous design exhibition here. And you can see that it's a lot of everyday objects on view, but the title it means that you have actual machine parts in a modern art museum on display, like ball bearings and propellers and railroad car springs, bits of machinery, as well as more everyday objects for normal use that kind of evoke this machine age spirit. So you have these pots and pans. You can actually see a little tea kettle here, many more pots and pans there. And this is a kind of series that was on display at Machine Art. This is Coors Chemical Porcelain. So companies that have already refined their goods and for laboratory use are starting to think, how can we expand our markets and get this kind of stuff into the home? So something like Coors Chemical Porcelain, they determine is very suitable to everyday use in the kitchen. On the right, this is a Lester Beal poster for the Rural Electrification Administration, which was founded in 1935 as part of FDR's New Deal. And this is just to show that it's really through the kitchen. The kitchen is a very powerful way of selling and making more comfortable the idea of electricity in the home for people who would be not really familiar with that concept. And just this very... the patriotic essence of this poster design. Here we are at the Corning Glassworks. So Corning actually unleashes Pyrex on the world around 1915, and it really explodes immediately after World War I. In 1917, 4.5 million pieces of Pyrex are sold. Now that includes more professional or chemical kind of glasswares, as well as objects for the home. But this is the traditional type of form that Corning was focusing on, these beakers for laboratory use. But again, they start to think, how can we expand our market and make these desirable for home use? So Pyrex being heat-resistant borosilicate glass, they start to tweak and experiment with new forms. They have their own laboratory, in-house scientists that are conducting very exciting experiments. And it's around 1935 that they develop what they call flameware. They tweak the formula for the borosilicate glass, and they make this type of object. Flameware is a type of Pyrex that you can apply direct flame to. So, by this measure, you can have a glass frying pan, which is kind of a very unusual image. It doesn't necessarily sit with you immediately. It looks kind of strange, but this was a completely functional object. The handle is detachable, and it's during World War II, when metals are rationed for wartime use, that they kind of complete the package and add a glass handle. So these three objects, the double boiler, the kettle, and the glass frying pan, are a nice representation of companies getting more creative in terms of innovating new objects based on a lack of materials, really. They have to explore. So now we're fully into World War II. These are some of our British wartime posters, which are on display in a nice little cluster in the exhibition. Here's reminding you to keep mice and rats. I think this is a rat, but to keep them out of your kitchen. And on the right, reminding you that you can raise your own rabbits. Rabbit meat is not rationed. So you can raise your own, feed them on kitchen scraps, and have this nice feedback loop of raising rabbits, eating rabbits. This is a series of three posters, actually, and the final one is just a casserole and has a list of dishes that you can make with your rabbits. But it's a very practical kind of campaign that you can have the health of a country is very important during wartime, and that they can be providing their own food. A more familiar take on that idea is probably this Victory Garden sort of image on the left in this Abram Games poster. Really beautiful, with the tableware emerging from the farm equipment, but that you can have, backyard gardens and sustain your family. And then on the right is the vegetable, this very appealing character made all out of vegetables. So what better way to signal a shift from this wartime really frugal and rational and efficient tone to post-war design for the kitchen than this giant glob of butter in this Swiss poster. This is a photograph on the left from Life magazine archives, but this is just to signal a new immediate post-war American environment of abundance and plenty, and that there are new processed foods, canned foods coming into kitchens, but also many new colors. Contact paper is released in 1954. More of the idea of personalizing your own kitchen, that you can have a blue refrigerator or a pink refrigerator, that it can be your own personal space. And hand in hand with that is the expansion of the kitchen in post-war America, especially in suburban homes. So now there's the idea of the living kitchen, and think how different this is from that the practical kitchen poster with the 36 square foot floor kitchen in Switzerland. This is pretty big, and it's meant not as a factory or a laboratory or a tiny little workspace, but as a living space, and it's meant for the whole family, and there's more enjoyment and abundance and color and lots of light, nice curtains. And companies, especially in the U.S., Frigidaire and Whirlpool and Hot Point and General Electric, many of whom were involved in contracting during World War II, are now just unleashing an army of new products to a very receptive American audience. Shopping malls are coming into play at this time. So there's just a whole lot of buying and producing and color. So maybe you do want a very high wall-mounted refrigerator looming above you as you speak on the telephone, and you can buy it, probably at a shopping mall.
What's that appliance on the right side of the sink?
The right side of... This looks like a toaster. Or you think it's
the whole yellow thing.
It looks like that does look like a washing machine. Yeah. Good question. And this really stunning Tom Wesselman painting, which we have in the gallery, is just a very nice way of showing not only new foods and branding in the kitchen, but just colors and this very poppy aesthetic. And MoMA, of course, in this age is concerned with kitchens. This is a photograph on the left of the second of three houses in the museum garden. This is the second one that was designed by architect Gregory Ain in 1950, and this is the kitchen. And you can see, let's see, here on the left, this little unassuming chair is actually one of my favorite works in our collection. It's not a, not a very famous chair. It's not a Le Corbusier chaise, and it's not, one of those very beautiful, innovative molded plywood high-frequency gluing chairs, but it's very nice little form. It was manufactured by the Ironwright Ironer Company in Detroit, and they had been, since around the turn of the century, manufacturing these what are called mangles, these electric ironing machines where you sit at a table and feed your clothing through instead of the old drudgery of laboring over an ironing board with your heavy iron. And so they decided what better way to round this out than provide the chair that you're meant to sit on at your ironing machine. And I like this because it's a nice example of pre-war ergonomic design, that it's supposed to support your back in the exact right way for sitting at this very machine. These are a few examples in our collection of American works from the late 1940s and 50s. Another thing that you see all the time and don't really think about is the flow-through tea bag, but that's released in about 1949. This very toothy 12-cut pie marker, which we have dangling upstairs, a salad basket, and this cleaver. And MoMA is collecting many objects meant for kitchens in this period, mostly because of two major exhibition campaigns or series. The first one is Useful Objects, which is from 1938 to 1948, and that's the precursor to the probably more famous series of exhibitions that were called Good Design, and that was a series of competitions and then corresponding exhibitions here and in Chicago. But MoMA is looking at everyday objects that are functional, not fussy, but where their appearance shows their function and their beauty emanates from that, and they're very clean and kind of noble objects. There's definitely a moral undertone to those exhibitions. But that's a good segue into Peter Schlumbohm, who's another one of my favorite designers in the collection. Here he is on the left. He's quite a larger-than-life character, apparently. He was actually a German chemist, and he came here to the United States in 1935. Shortly after that, he invents this Chemex coffee maker, which you may have seen. I actually use this in my house. It makes an appearance in a few of the James Bond books, actually. It's part of James Bond's breakfast, the Chemex coffee maker. That's in 1941. This is a slightly later patent drawing. But anyway, Peter Schlumbohm is a wonderful example of this continuation of that kitchen as laboratory perspective and following through into the post-war era. So all of these objects, and it's striking how unified they are, but you know, most of them are for coffee or cocktail shakers. This is an ice bucket here, water kettle, other sorts of flasks. This is a really large, this is a 2.5 gallon coffee maker, and it has a little spigot that the regular size Chemex sits underneath. That's for more restaurant use. But these are all using cork and Pyrex and aluminum and stainless steel. They're very simple, reduced forms, obviously laboratory equipment inspired. The Chemex is really steps away from an Erlenmeyer flask. Simple, true materials. And none of these are electrical appliances. They're not expensive. They're just exactly what they look like. He even designed this little cigarette holder, which is kind of Chemex shaped. I would really like to have met him. Another continuation into the post-war period is a lingering concern for labor saving and time saving. This is a great photograph taken in a Swedish test kitchen that was run by the Holmes Research Institute, or HFI was the Swedish acronym. But that was founded just at the end of World War II. And so it's still in Europe and America of great concern to really optimize kitchen layouts, even as kitchens are starting to expand and have this flood of color and explosion of new products. People, designers and home engineers are still very, very concerned with this. And they're able to feed into this kind of research new developments that were a direct result of World War II engineering and design, not only in materials like plastics and improvements to aluminum and plexiglass, but also new studies in anthropometrics, the study of the human body, and ergonomics, which is how anthropometrics is applied to design. So people start to really think about handles and environments. If you think about design during World War II of the cockpit of a fighter jet, or the handles of rifles or crutches, or really anything where you have to be just no-nonsense design, comfortable, it works, you can tell how it works, don't want any mistakes, and that kind of thinking and development gets applied after World War II and really makes a huge impact on everyday items that enter the home. This is a very nice kitchen clock with the timer built in. This is a recent acquisition to our collection as well, designed by Max Bill, who was a student at the Bauhaus School of Design and helped found, he was one of the co-founders of the Hochschule in Ulm in Germany, which is considered the second most influential school of design after the Bauhaus. But it's a very beautiful blue color, I think. He also designed the numbers even for the clock, not just the form. This, I'll give you a minute. This is an article from Popular Science. I'm just going to check on my time here. This is an article from Popular Science. One of the fun things about being a curatorial assistant is not only the pleasure of working with our amazing and very rich collection of objects and our archives and library, but that I can go explore on eBay and buy issues of Popular Science and fit them into our exhibitions. So that's how we got this one. But you can see the woman inside of the calipers. And I included this just to speak to the point of this kind of tension that arises where designers are thinking about anthropometrics and ergonomics and what is the length of the average housewife's arm and what is the average height. This is where we get the standard height of 36 inch high countertops, unless you're Julia Child at 6'2", who needs her countertops at 39 inches. But there's a tension and kind of a conflict between the aims of these designers and when you take it to this extent, the title of this article, New Kitchen Built to Fit Your Wife, and this kind of disturbing image of the servile housewife in the calipers, it takes it to a new level, and it seems a little bit gross. and something that you don't want to buy into. But at the same time, the designers and architects who are creating these kitchens and objects in this mindset often have very practical and even progressive aims of making environments more functional and just fit the body. So it's not a tension that is easily resolved, but it's one that we hope people will think about, that you can literally build a woman into a kitchen, and what are the what are the ramifications of that? But of course, the goal in all of this is release from drudgery, as this advertisement displays. You can see, is this the pointer or pen? This is a pen. You can see the kind of vestigial, cloudy remnants of the old kitchen, almost haunted looking, the old stove and some kind of terrible washer basin. But she's running off into the new modern kitchen with her baby, and her chains are broken. And it's that kind of tone that is very much at play in something like the kitchen debate in 1959. So here's a good connection back to our title, Counter Space. We didn't want this exhibition just to be a display or a parade of pretty objects or of, you know, attractive architectural drawings. We wanted to get to a more polemical aspect of the kitchen, and that kitchens are not only where major innovations are entering the home, but really kind of a battleground for society to think about how, you know, the nature of women in the home and the nature of domestic labor and what kind of food is in your kitchen and where does your food come from and what are the materials in your kitchen. And so here in this very famous kitchen debate between Nixon, vice president at the time, and Soviet Premier Khrushchev, who is aggressively pointing at him in this kitchen, they're fighting about a kitchen. But as with all fights that happen in a kitchen, it's not really about the kitchen. It's about national ideology. And so Nixon is saying, this is at the American National Exhibition. So this is a typical American suburban kitchen that he's showing. And it's actually a General Electric kitchen, and it was bright canary yellow. But he's saying this is the kind of thing that we can provide in America with our in our democracy, in our capitalist democracy. And we have all of this abundance and a freedom of choice. And that means that our lifestyle is better and our quality of life is better. And so all of this, he's using the kitchen as his set of tools for this argument. And Khrushchev is pointing and saying, we don't think about the kitchen that way. And we feel, you know, America is one of the greatest country in the world, and all you think about is kitchens, and we don't always have our women in the kitchen. So it's a very famous debate, and just very interesting that it all takes place and hinges around the kitchen. Another familiar type of object is Tupperware. It's in 1947 that Earl Tupper perfects his line that was previously called Welcomeware. This is his polyethylene kind of similar sorts of objects, but he perfects the seal, that burping seal that is food tight and watertight, and that's when Tupperware is born. So not only are these forms pretty new in their material, the colors and the forms, like this popsicle mold, which it's really fun to see people run up to this in the exhibition and have such fond memories of popsicles. But also in the marketing of Tupperware, which is very innovative. It's actually Brownie Weiss, who's here in this photograph, who is a single mother living in Texas, and she joined the company and ended up becoming the vice president. And it was her idea to have this marketing structure of the home sales, where housewives could have this independent income based on selling Tupperware and having these parties. So I like this story because it reminds us that design is not just about the thinking process or the drawing process or the manufacturing process, but really the whole story of an object and how it's unleashed on the world and how it enters into your life. It's a bigger picture. Of course, it's not only Tupperware that is taking advantage of new plastic production and technology. These are some examples from different countries. This Swedish pitcher. Italian companies are really taking off with plastics, especially a company like Cartel, which Gino Colombini here at the bottom left, he worked for Cartel, which was founded in 1949 and based in Milan. And it's around the same time that Tupperware is taking off that a company like Cartel in Italy is starting to really take advantage of the aesthetic as well as the material aspects of plastic. I really like this because you might not even know what it is unless you see here that it's a shrimp cleaner, but I think that's an attractive little guy. This is a set of brochures, again, just to show a range of products and colors in the home, but this is for Alcan Foil, the Canadian aluminum company. Another fun part of my job is sometimes we're contacted by designers in the collection. So Ralph Harder, who's just lovely, came a few weeks ago, and I was able to give him a tour of Counterspace and see what he thought. It was really fun. Brown. So we've been focusing a lot on America in this post-war section of the exhibition, but you know, there's a slight delay, obviously, from the real devastation Europe side of World War II. And it's, so it's a little bit later that companies in Germany and other European countries start to get their footing back. But a company like Brown, which was actually founded in 1921, again in Frankfurt, it all comes back to Frankfurt, really starts to take off. And the design director at Brown, Dieter Rams, who's known for his famous mantra, omit the unimportant, which I think you can really see in something like this toaster. He was the design director there for about 30 years, which is so impressive. And you know, this kind of kitchen it's called the multi-purpose kitchen machine, which I think is amazing when you know that it was designed in 1957, because it looks exactly like something you would buy today. But it's really echoing that kind of efficient ethos of before World War II, because you use the same motor for all of these different purposes. So you don't have a whole smattering of objects using different motors and plugging in whiches and whats, and it doesn't make sense, that kind of product arrangement, and especially when you see something so elegantly executed as this machine. But these are also brown objects. Another kind of star of the show in the exhibition is this Italian kitchen, very, very different from the Frankfurt kitchen, still very small, but now the kitchen is conceived as a unit and a mobile unit. This is on casters. This was designed in 1968, and it folds up into this little cube or out in this kind of spread position. Has really everything that you need, a stovetop, a refrigerator, a pull-out cutting board, tons of storage, all built in. It's on casters, and we actually have it upstairs on a rotating platform to capture that glam late 60s aspect of it. But a pretty revolutionary way of thinking about the kitchen when you see it in the context of the rest of the exhibition. These are some later objects. This company, Ergonomi Design Gruppen, reflects a kind of alternative design thinking following this 50s and 60s just proliferation of new goods, sometimes just for the sake of new goods. This is a design consultancy that focuses almost exclusively on design for people with physical disabilities and for seniors. So just like the new immediate post-war equipment that I was discussing where people are really thinking about handles, like of your kitchen knives, it's the same idea, but with a slightly more targeted purpose here. This is the kind of object that was featured in the 1988 MoMA exhibition Design for Independent Living. And then here, the very different type of vegetable peeler from the earlier Echo Products kitchen peeler. So Smart Design, another design consultancy, they're based in New York. Just doing amazing things with everyday objects that sometimes for decades go unchanged until there's a light bulb and they just create an entirely new form. More kind of alternative design thinking in this period. Here's a solar cooker. Adnan Tarsisi was actually a diplomat. That was his profession. So international politics is the main activity of his life, but he has this side passion for solar energy and solar cooking. And it was in Lebanon in 1955 that he said, you know, two-thirds of your average worker's income is spent on fuel. And why should that be when 8 to 9 months of the year the sun is blazing away? So what can we do about this? He designed probably a dozen different solar cookers starting in the mid-1950s. This is one from about 1970 that we have that is also nice because it captures this kind of satellite space age form. Although it also sometimes looks like a peacock to me, but it actually folds down, like boop, 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 it all folds down. And then this back part is, which is the spine almost when it's open, that is the box that it all folds into, and it has a little handle. So it's very compact, but then unfolds onto this tripod base, and then up here is where your food goes. There's a 1954 New York Times article that was called A Limitless Resource, and it actually had a picture of Adnan Tarsisi cooking hot dogs on one of his earlier model solar cookers. I don't know how long that would take, but it's a very interesting idea and kind of signaling just a new way of thinking about what is a kitchen and how do we use energy in the kitchen. And then this is a set of new a new product that's called Jar Tops. So this very young Dutch designer who's based in London has created this set of just tops you screw onto jars. So instead of throwing away your olive jar or your jam jar, you can give it a new life and a new purpose by attaching these little sifters or pouring spouts, and it helps you reuse materials that you have. You don't need to throw them away, and it's just a very elegant solution to this this small problem. Finally, and very quickly so that we have time for questions, the third section of the exhibition is called Kitchen Sink Dramas, and this is where we wanted to confront the reality of the kitchen, because often the kitchen is such a far cry from the visions of architects and designers and manufacturers and advertisers. The kitchen is a place of mess and mishap and accidents. It's the most dangerous room in the house by far. Sex and violence in the kitchen, confusion in the kitchen. That's my own personal experience in the kitchen. Great confusion, consternation. And so here we've really reached into the other departments of the museum, and they've allowed us to bring in these works of photography and painting and sculpture to show how artists have responded to the idea of the kitchen, either as a myth or as a dream or as a nightmare, and included it in their works of art since the 60s. So this Mac Adams toaster photograph on the left, you can see the reflection of the woman in the toaster, and then this amazing expression on this woman's face with the knife in this Dikorsia photograph. Because kitchens, of course, are reflected back to us all of the time in media and in commercial advertising and in films. We have some film stills upstairs. So this is just a few. Full of Life at the bottom with Judy Holliday, who's fallen through the kitchen floor. Uncle Buck. At the top left is Charlie Chaplin in Modern Times in 1936. And then this is my favorite, The Apartment, because it almost looks just like a regular old kitchen scene. And then you see that he's straining the spaghetti on a tennis racket. But so many artists have taken cues from the kitchen in their work. Cindy Sherman, this is one of her unidentified film stills, really gets you to think about the about identity in the kitchen and feminist artists confronting this kind of happy housewife myth and just performance and personal performance in the kitchen. Laurie Simmons has a series of dollhouse interiors, including some kitchens. This is a Mary Frey photograph with this kind of very happy, familiar interaction between a mother and daughter making meatballs. And then another Decortia photograph, another very familiar moment of just staring into the refrigerator, and maybe it's 2 a.m. It looks like it might be from that photograph. And these amazing William Eggleston photographs, just getting into the grit and grime of the interior of this stove, and then the freezer, because when you think about a freezer, it really does put your foods, and probably your most processed foods, in this state of arrested decay, and there's just this crazy amount of ice encrusting the inside, and you really don't want to know what's in the back of that freezer. And then this Rosenquist painting, which is a nice large one, upstairs with the razor blade, and taking, again, familiar images, the t-shirt, the can opener, the eggs, and juxtaposing them in a kind of unsettling way that I think is very cool. And I like to end with this image of this series of photographs that are called Kitchen Frenzy by Anna and Bernhard Blum. And this is a very large set of photographs, and it really kind of anchors that third section. And I just love the chaos and the kind of... It's just so crazy that this housewife, who actually is Anna Blum in the photographs, has just lost complete control of her potatoes. It's almost a burlesque kind of scene. It's just very, very nice set of photographs. That wraps up the presentation. I'm very happy to answer any questions that you have. Yes. Yes. The housing estates are still there. That one. The question was if the housing estate that our Frankfurt kitchen comes from, is it still there? The housing estates. I'm not sure that all of them are still there, but that Ginheim one is. Many of there was a lot of wartime damage to them, but the ones that still stand. In many cases, the kitchens have been removed. Although there were 10,000 of them produced and installed in these apartments, many of them have been removed, sometimes because there's not room for a refrigerator, which people want. But we actually worked with a preservation or heritage agency that's based in Stuttgart, and they helped us locate and take our Frankfurt kitchen. They've been researching and preserving Frankfurt kitchens for many years. It's a wonderful group. And so they helped us. And that's why we're so lucky to have all of the little bits and pieces, like the faucet. We have the light switches, the aluminum pouring bins, the window, the glass in the window. It's all original. So all that we really had to do was kind of put the ceiling on, the box that houses the kitchen we created. We did a new linoleum floor, but linoleum was very popular with modernist architects at the time. Very easy to clean, nice colors and texture. And then the tiles are original behind the sink area, but we just had to install them. So it was an amazing project putting it together. And because it's open on three sides, we wanted it free-floating in the space, not kind of installed in a corner. So you can experience it as a design unit and get nice perspective all around it. And we treated the exterior walls of the Frankfurt kitchen so that they would be appropriate to what would be, if you continued the layout. So this is the outside. This is kind of a rough cast exterior treatment. And then this would be the living room. So it's a nice, bright, textured yellow wallpaper. And then the other side in the back, where the hallway would be, is a more subdued gray, a beautiful gray plaid with a metallic thread through it. And that was actually donated to us by a vintage wallpaper store here. So there were really fun projects that went along figuring out the layout of the exhibition. Another great one was creating this trellis, which our exhibition designer, Lana Hum, did just excellently. And it allowed us to have a very dense presentation of objects, but you can see through from the early part of the exhibition to the later part. And so there's a dialogue, and it's dense, but it's not overwhelming, we hope. Any other questions? Okay, we're out of time. Sorry. Thank you.